thing where we have this.
If you are listening to the show and wish to join us in the chat room, visit powtalk.com. Go to the social issues, select other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Breaking news, strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God, they're beaming me up with them. Put that probe there. Don't put the... Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you the high strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Hey everybody, this is Erica Getch, and I want to keep you connected every Friday night at 8 p.m. Pacific on The Galactic Connection. As always, I'll be taking your calls in the second hour, and as always, TGC is glad to be a part of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. So please check out TGCRadio.com. Hope to see you there.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hey everybody, this is Erica Getch, and I want to keep you connected every Friday night at 8 p.m. Pacific on The Galactic Connection. As always, I'll be taking your calls in the second hour, and as always, TGC is glad to be a part of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. So please check out TGCRadio.com. Hope to see you there.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news. But you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Over that music.
Well, actually, we are live. So, folks,
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight, as usual, we've got a wonderful program. But before we go off to that conversation, I have my usual announcements to make. For tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So please send your questions and comments to me at GiaScott@exogenynetwork.com. I promise I will not give out anybody's full name or email, and I won't send you any spam. So don't be shy. I know you have something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. And don't forget, there is a page on Facebook for all of you Facebookers out there where you can easily post comments and ask for future topics. I also have an author page, which you can also go and click like on, showing me support for my written endeavors. And don't forget to email me directly, whether it's questions for tonight's guest or about something else with the program. You can send that email off to GiaScott@exogenynetwork.com. Now, tonight, we are fortunate to have a guest co-host joining us as well, and we've got our guest, too. So before we get started, many of you may recognize Claudia Dallaire as a previous guest herself. Claudia, would you introduce yourself to the audience?
Oh, gladly, Gia. My name is Claudia Dallaire. I am an author. I have 3 nonfiction books on different aspects of ancient Egyptian magic, Egyptian love spells and rituals, Egyptian prosperity magic, and Egyptian revenge spells. That's terrible. I have to remember their titles. And I am now branching out into fiction. My first novel, The Wrath of Amun, is a mystery set in ancient Egypt. And the second novel in the series, The Talisman of Tahuti, is under contract and is being edited even as we speak.
Great, great, great. And tonight's guest is another author as we continue our author conversations. This time we're talking with an author, and okay, you might have to forgive me a little bit. I'm not real good at these gender things or genre things.
Female.
Gender I figured out. Genre I have trouble with. But I would call it, I guess, a science fiction type thriller. So
I think it is.
Book, and I enjoyed it immensely, but I must confess, yeah, I'm sure I ran into one of her characters out in the woods one day, one man called Mudflap. So, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself, Rita?
Hi, Gia. My name is Rita Kimpley, and my first novel is called The Vessel, and it involves it's not a happy world, but it's a funny world. It's dystopic New York. I wanted to make it actually only about 20 years from now, but everyone convinced me that was too pessimistic. But New York is pretty much underwater, and the people there, the rich people, of course, are doing well, and the poor people, of course, are not doing well. It's pretty much status quo. And that book, there's like websites out the wazoo for the vesselnovel.com, and besides from that, before I got into that, I was at the Washington Post as a movie critic for approximately 25 years. Then the newspaper industry fell out from under many of us and is sadly still declining. And so what did I do? Go right back to publishing, which is, of course, declining. So here I am at your mercy.
It's not so much, at least with books, I don't think it's so much declining as it is shifting.
Exactly.
Because more and more people are discovering the wonders of the ebook. And I have to admit, I'm sort of falling in line with the rest of the world. I tried my first one, I guess it was probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I went, you know what, I kind of like this. And then I became injured, which left me with an arm that doesn't work very well. And physically holding a book became not very much fun. And I lost one of my, you know, dearest pleasures, which was curling up in bed with the paperback. Can't do that. I can't hang on to the book.
Oh, no.
So
what happened?
I had to put it at a table. So if you have to sit at a table to read a book, it's just as easy to read it on your computer, which is where I read my first e-book. And I have to admit, I haven't bit the bullet and bought an e-reader. I still read. I just use the apps on a laptop and read from there. And I love e-books. It allows me to read just as fast as always, and my arm never gets tired.
That's a good idea.
So, yeah, I did for my mother's birthday last year, I guess it was. And she's no spring chicken. We got her a Kindle.
Oh,
she loves her Kindle. In fact, she's talking now about upgrading to a larger one with color because we just got her a Kindle Touch. And she loves her Kindle and loves reading with it and protects it fiercely from her sisters. So, that's...
The problem we face, I think, is I don't. Did you produce independently your book, or
independently?
Did you,
yes.
Those of us who try to publish independently have a big problem in that we have to do a lot of marketing, and I, for one, am completely bewildered. I've taken all these social media courses on online, and every time I take one, I find a need a new thing like a squeeze page. I have no idea what it was. So I find myself sitting there reading, what the heck is a squeeze page? I read it and I still have no clue.
It does leave you kind of lost and floundering. And, I think the same thing is true for the readers who are looking for the books. It's hard to find. Like before, we used to always maintain on our website, we kept a whole section of book reviews. Well, we had trouble with our website starting, I guess, about a year and a half ago. And it's been in turmoil continuously, and it's still not been all put back together for a long list of reasons, and, which is neither here nor there. But the physical work of maintaining that site and then the relatively small traffic that would actually see it.
Exactly.
Lately, I was kind of questioning, do we really need to go to all that much work to put up that page again? And is it really going to benefit anybody at all? And I just, I talked to some other authors and whatnot, and I decided that for me, because of the fact that I review a lot of books,
yeah,
I needed something easy. And I said, okay, I'm not going to try and do all the websites. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
So I narrowed it down to two. I'm only doing two now, which I review them on Amazon and I review them on Goodreads. I decided that was the two that was going to make it simple, benefit the readers and the authors the most, and put it where it was most accessible to people. Goodreads, kind of came out ahead. There's a whole bunch of websites that cater to readers.
Right.
And that was the one that I decided was probably the one that – it was the horse I was going to bet on, put it short briefly.
Right,
you know?
right.
And that's what it is at this stage of the game with ebooks and the changing and publishing and everything, was you just had to put your – bet on a horse. Pick one out of the crowd.
Just go. Get on that sucker and ride him. So we have something in common, I think, in our books, don't we? And that's the people facing the end of the world and how to survive. My cat is trying to climb up my chair.
Cat. That involved with you when you're busy. They're like children. the whole post-apocalyptic thing. Mine's sort of right at that point, whereas yours is, a little bit further down the line. But there are some similarities.
Except your people are really nice, according to all your reviews. I bought your book. It hasn't come yet, so I'm excited to see it.
Your
people are very nice, it sounds like, according to the reviews.
Yes, It's very different from the one you wrote, which that's a good thing, I think.
Yep, that's a good thing.
It'd be frightening if they were very similar.
Yes, it would be very scary. My people are all quite deranged, I think, but that would happen, wouldn't it?
I can identify with these characters. This character Mudflap,
Yes, you like Mr. Mudflap.
First of all, it's funny to think of, this character climbing out of a pile of junk cars. No memory of how the heck he got there. And, he's stark naked, and the only thing you can find to wear is a pair of mud flaps. And, okay.
That's
I'm
good.
I'm sure, that I've encountered this guy out in the woods.
That's what you told me.
I'm pretty sure.
Was he mud flapped or have a hubcap on his head or something?
No. He had actually, the story he gave me was him and his girlfriend had come out into the woods the night before. Uh-huh. And he'd gotten stuck, and he'd fallen in the creek.
Uh-huh.
And got lost, and lost his keys, and his wallet, and his cell phone.
Mm.
Which may or may not be true.
It may be, actually, for the best.
I was a little concerned that something more untoward than that story had happened to a girlfriend who came walking up to our campsite because the girlfriend wasn't with him. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, because this was supposedly a first date. I'm thinking to myself,
you know, it might have also been a last date. Indeed, it might have.
You know, I ended up in the woods, stuck all night, and it was cold weather. It was winter time. We were camping in the winter. No, that's not real cold, but it's still, it's colder than you want to be.
Exactly, I would think.
So anyhow, I'm thinking, she let him walk off without her?
Yeah.
Case of, oh,
perhaps.
No.
Maybe she left him in the tent and went back to town.
Well, he didn't have any clothes, and he didn't have a coat.
Poor thing.
Mm.
She probably took the coat.
No, he didn't have one.
Okay. Well.
It was just one of those stories that just, okay.
So did he go ahead and start a goat farm and make cheese?
No, actually.
No?
I don't think he had that plans that far forward.
I see.
Actually, no, my husband, I wanted no part of this guy. My husband did take him to civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So that he
nice.
Recruit help to recover his car and his girlfriend. Now, I'm always wondering, though, was there ever a second date?
Oh, I
doubtful.
Was there ever a second date? Because I'm thinking, you know, I've had some real bad dates in my years, but
if there was if it was a match, if it was a love match. She's probably back out there with him. They probably have a pop-up tent now. Everything's probably great.
Oh.
Yes. So how about, what do you think is the animal of the future? I am betting on the goat. How about you? I'm goats to eat the ivy. Here, I live in the city, and we have all this English ivy. And I want to get a couple of goats. And every time I put that on Facebook, everybody they go crazy. I get more responses about possible goat purchase from people than anything else I ever write about. They just hate goats.
In the past, okay? I've actually owned them, milked them, bred them.
Yes.
They are the most destructive animals on earth.
But
goats that I had that didn't bash, crash, it's that. That's where I learned how to rope, was on goats. My own goats, catch them. My granddad tried to teach me my whole life. I never did, because I come from a cowboy family, roping, you're supposed to do it.
Yes, I saw. But you never did, you roped a goat, but nothing else?
No, well, I eventually ended up roping horses, but I learned how on catching my goats, because they were continually escaping, and they could outrun me.
Mm. Well, they're wily.
I learned to rope. I did own Angora goats, and they were much more placid. They were not as destructive. The Nubians were the most destructive. I actually got rid of the Nubians because I was just tired of fixing fences. But with the avian flu, before the avian flu, I would have said chickens.
Yeah.
But with the avian flu thing and its rise in China recently, I'm afraid we may see some issues involving poultry. Or
I'm going with the goat and the northern snakehead, which I feature quite prominently. That's about all there is to eat in my book is northern snakehead. Everybody freaked out when they, you know, found them here in the D.C. area in a pond. And, you know, they were certain that they were going to take over. And, you know, they're cool because they can walk on land. And so I think they have a prominent place in our future. Cuisine. You're a cook, right? You're like a big cook?
Then again, there's the shark. I mean, they formed the shark up past St. Louis in the Mississippi River, the shark.
Wow. What about the shrimp, the mantis shrimp? That's down your all's way, isn't it?
The which shrimp?
There's a shrimp that it's not even a shrimp, and it's called a mantis shrimp because it looks like a praying mantis, but it's huge.
Ooh.
And it's got a claw that is gigantic, and it's so strong that it can knock out the walls of an aquarium. And people
Sweet.
End up,
wow.
Yeah, it can cut off your thumb. But anyway, that's a
oh,
new.
Why would anyone want one of these?
Well, they put them in their aquarium because they're very pretty. They're very attractive, unless they chop off your finger. So, but people thought, well, and threw them apparently down in the Gulf of Mexico. So they're apparently causing a ruckus down there, like the northern snakehead here. And so I think
that somehow, but I haven't been paying that much attention to the fishing industry. And we moved inland a little ways last summer, so
yeah.
We're about miles off the coast now.
Well, now, see, you can't forget these things, though, because if you're going to be doing cuisine, you can't just stick with chocolate.
You can't stick to chocolate. As a matter of fact, today I released another one, fudges this time.
My Lord.
Yeah. So 55 fudges.
55 fudges.
Wow.
Yeah. So anybody who's interested in a fudge cookbook, you can go to bit.ly/55fudges, and you'll find
Ooh.
It there. It's released. And
I should have told anybody to go to Amazon.com, but I don't have my Bitly thing.
I did the Bitly thing because the Amazon links are too long.
You're right.
So the first thing I have my husband set them up. Because I'm kind of lazy. I used to do it myself, but here lately I've been, I guess, kind of lazy. And I just say, would you please? He also does book cover designs for me. So
does my husband, happily.
Yeah.
He used to be a graphic designer once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he became an agent for us, for our screenplays, which we never got produced. But we did have some awards, and now he's a realtor because, you know, you have to do something to make actual money other than being these creative fields, you know?
Uh-huh. And, Claudia, you know, whether you realized it or not, you've been a huge force in me going forward with doing anything.
Well, thank you. I like to hear that. I like to know that I inspire people.
For people who are listening, Claudia has mentored many authors. She hasn't done as much with me besides just providing sort of general information and support. And sometimes that's what you need. So, yeah.
I've mentored several writers, and I love it. That's I feel all writers should have a support system because we do most of our work in a solitary environment. We write in a vacuum, and it's nice to have someone that you can, you know, call on and say, you know, can you read this? Am I doing this right? You know, how do I query a publisher? Ask me.
That's what I'm here for. That's nice of you.
And, you know, two of the gentlemen that I've mentored, I've edited their books. And I've done it for free. And I've told them the same thing. All I ask is that at some time in your career as an author, I want you to do the same for another up-and-coming writer. Because you need to pay this forward. That's the way I am.
I feel like you sort of just... I always ended up doing that just because. I've never thought of it as mentoring or anything, but most people that I know, I've like been writing for, 50 years or so. And just during that period, you know, you're just willing, somebody says, hey, will you take a look at this? And then you end up taking a look at it, and you end up taking more of a look than they thought you were going to take.
Here's a question for the both of you who have more experience at mentoring than I do, certainly. In the past, I have been asked to look at other people's work. I've had a little bit of writing experience, and of course, you know, I can read and I can talk, too.
There you go.
But you know, when you look at somebody's work and it's really, really awful.
Yeah.
It happens. I mean, where you're not even sure what they're trying to say. It's not that they're saying it in a bad way so much as
you don't know.
In my case, it happened to be some nonfiction material, and I was like, I couldn't think of a nice way to put it. I just said, I can't help you.
Whoa, that's a bad girl.
I said, there's nothing I can do to improve this, which was the truth.
That's good. Okay, that's good. As long as it's positive. You're just supposed to be positive.
You know, if there was nothing, there's nothing I can do to improve this, you know, or when you're asked to edit something and it reads like a fourth grader's book report.
Yeah.
And there's no way to edit it. You need to rewritten is what it needs. You know, are there more? I'm not real good at tact. I'll admit that. You know, people tell me it's because I'm an Aries, and Aries are never tactful. But I have all the tact of the average St. Bernard at a china shop.
Yeah.
With a butcher shop just outside, you know. Yeah. and I do. I just kind of, here I go. And trying to figure out a way to be tactful is often quite difficult.
You have to fight that. I'm usually very blunt and horrifyingly blunt, and people would always say to me when I would write a review, they say, well, tell us, what do you really think? You know, which means, of course, I just burned in a new one. But when you're dealing with somebody who's, you know, writing and they're tender, I mean, especially if they're new, they take everything so to heart. If you've been around a long time and you've dealt with a lot of editors, you become accustomed to being edited, and you know that that person is not trying to hurt you. Some of them maybe, yes, but by and large, they're trying to help you, you know, and wouldn't be saying, look, take this out or pedal back on this or, you know, unless they really, really care. Now, if you can possibly, I mean, at the same time, you don't want to encourage people to go off and spend, you know, 20 years trying to write when they're not doing much more than a fourth grade. But what you might want to do is try referring them to a writing class and say, you know, this is very interesting. Or as you said, I really can't do anything to improve this work, but perhaps you'd like to go to Media Bistro and, you know, take a memoir writing class. You know, something like that. Just, I think, you know, and let somebody with more experience at mentoring or whatever guide them in the right direction. I think that's the best thing. I don't think you want to hurt anybody.
Through life being nasty and hurtful.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, you could be honest, and I've done it too, you know, but you got to be, you know, you've really got to soft pedal it with people when it's their art or their music or their writing. I think they're so vulnerable.
Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, my case, I would be dealing with people who were, they didn't intend it for anything more than maybe a newsletter or a club's website or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, an article. It wasn't like writing was a big, but they wanted to be involved in the process, you might say. And then you get this piece and it's like, it's really embarrassingly awful. And there's nothing to be done with it. Because if you change much of it, they're going to be upset too.
Exactly.
And it's just plain awful. And, you know, in the past, I've learned how to bury things so that they weren't easily found, you know, and things like that. And maybe it's not nice, but at the same time, I sort of regarded it as the lesser of evils.
I suppose. I don't know. I really don't know what you're going to do. They're going to continue to write regardless, right?
Not necessarily. In my case, I never got material from the two individuals I'm thinking about. They never submitted material again. It took them a long time to write the piece, and it was something that most people could write fairly quickly. You know, and I'm talking, it took weeks to produce it, you know, and I'm like, maybe writing's really not your thing, you know.
Well, probably it isn't, but, you know, here's the thing again, I'll just say this. I got writer's block about three years ago, and I thought, what the heck, you know, I just can't think of anything. So I decided I'll take a memoir writing class. So I took this memoir writing class, and some of the people, you know, weren't, you know, professional writers, and some were, et cetera. And so regardless of what level they were at, I was really amazed that people would be given the writing cues and they would submit the work. And the people who would teach a class used only constructive criticism, and you had to do the same thing. It was good practice for people in criticizing others too. And lo and behold, even the worst person's work, I was astonished, came up to so many levels just because people were giving them this constructive and kind criticism. I was absolutely fascinated by that. So I don't know what to tell you. I think if you bumping them off will be good, I suppose, if you can't deal with it, but just give them another suggestion. Suggest a writing group in town or something like that, I think.
Yeah. I've just recently joined a writing group, and I find I'm getting a lot of I'm getting positive feedback, but I'm also getting constructive criticism.
Exactly.
And it's fabulous to be able to network with these other people,
mm-hmm.
and we all write in different genres,
mm-hmm.
so it's wonderful to network with these people, to hear what they're writing, and
exactly.
to listen to their voices and see their style, because
exactly.
it's wonderful to be with all of these creative people.
I was part of a group too. The same thing. It was nonfiction, so I didn't really quite belong. But really, I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's wonderful the kind of different criticism that people can offer and how kind it is and really how enforcing it can be to be a part of a group like that.
And too,
well,
I
our
think...
group.
Go ahead, Claudia.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, I was going to say our group is unique because we have both fiction and nonfiction writers. Some are working on memoirs. Actually, they're translating families' diaries, which is absolutely fascinating. One woman is translating her grandfather's diaries from World War I.
That's interesting.
So a lot of our group is very unique, and we have so many things going on. It's really exciting.
This is the wildest character, and she's a lovely woman, and she sadly has developed cancer and seems to be tragically ill, but she was actually a crack whore of all things in one of my middle classes, you know, a middle-class Asian-American crack whore. And I just, you know, you don't run into that very often. Do you know what I mean?
No.
So you run into some interesting people, you know.
Yes.
With some fabulous tales to tell. You know?
And I think sometimes taking a class in something related to writing.
Exactly.
Can be mind expanding. I took a class in screenplays.
Yeah.
I had no interest in screenplays, but I thought, okay, I could afford the fee. It sounds interesting. You know, I'll learn something. And it was just something to do. Because I hadn't taken the class in a long time.
Co-written, like my husband and I used to wrote them. I think we wrote about 10 of them, you know, and we just had some crazy, we had some times. But it's an interesting, it's not the same at all as writing, say, in fiction or nonfiction. It's plumbing, as they say.
Well, the way the class was taught, I guess kickstarting on a creative process, because he told us that we could apply the same writing, I guess, methodology as he was teaching us to use to anything, whether you're writing a book, a screenplay, whatever.
For sure, but the structure
is interesting. Yeah,
the structure is so important.
Yeah, and you know, I guess maybe I didn't retain the structure as much because screenplays weren't where my interests lie.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, I really did pick up more about the creative process and sort of mental organization.
Yeah.
I tend to be like a cannon loaded with shotgun shells.
Yeah, I just...
yeah. Large pattern, not much
flatter. I used to call it a word salad, you know?
I tell my husband, because he tends to give too much information anytime you ask him a question. Instead
mm-hmm.
of a straight monosyllabic answer. I still think he's vomiting information on people.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, when you're looking for a yes or no and you get a five-minute dissertation.
That's hard.
You know, yeah.
But I understand and appreciate that he has all that information to give.
I really didn't know the, you know, how bread was invented when I ask if you want a sandwich or white or whole wheat.
Then what did he say? He tell you? What would an answer be?
This is an ongoing thing with us, you know, so mm-hmm. I've been telling him that for years. But he does the same thing to everybody. So whether it's a coworker, it's a supervisor, it's a customer, whatever, he's, you know, just drowning them in information.
And info. Well, I guess it got a lot to say.
Okay. Be that, or I'm not a real good conversationalist. So you starve for, you know, the chance to talk.
And well, see, wonder why that is.
At some point in time, I would love to take a screenwriting course. I would love to learn how to write. I would like to learn how to write a play. Is what I would like to do.
Well, then you should take. You shouldn't take a screenwriting class at all, then, because it's going to be totally different kind of thing.
Totally different? Okay.
Well, not totally different, but it's going to be different enough. I mean, because they're really, I don't find them similar. I mean, if you're writing a musical, say, and you need a book that's, you know, not that developed, then yes, you know, because you see so many, they're stealing all kinds of movies and putting them on Broadway now, but they tend to be simple musicals. But for a play, you're really going to have to develop and get far, far deeper into the character than you would in a screenplay, you know, because action and character, as they always say, character is action. But with a play, I don't think you're going to have more time to expand the character. And they're going to be talking all the time, too. And you're never going to be away from them. Whereas in screenplays, you're moving around as much as you can to keep all kinds of visual action. That's quite the opposite of what you got on stage.
Hmm.
I guess
me thinks. He thinks. Me may be full of it, but.
But it's, you know, you don't really think about the differences in the forms of media. A lot of people say, oh, I'll wait till the movie or the TV program comes out, you know, anytime they hear about another bestseller. You know, I find it really disappointing usually when I see the movie made on a book because the book was so much better.
Yeah.
You know, then that's a common complaint.
Yeah, and part of that is that I've seen them, well, for instance, when I was still reviewing movies, I remember it was the first Harry Potter. And what you have to do if you're developing, say, something as, you know, as revered as Harry Potter or as followed as Harry Potter, is you're going to have to totally follow every bit of the plot and without jettisoning many of the characters. And then you'll find that you don't have a very good movie, you know. But they have to be religious in Harry Potter's. And Hunger Games, I think they did a little better job, you know. But you're still going to have to include more incidents, more characters, more things that a person who's read the book expects. You know, which works fine in a novel because you can, you know, wander around a bit, you know, spend time. But when you're sitting in a theater and you start to wiggle, you know, after about 45 minutes. So you've got to keep people really gripped in that action, you know, and manipulating them visually as opposed to manipulating them by word. That's why it's so hard to turn a internal, you know, dialogue, a book that is internal dialogue, into a movie. You know, so it's a far, far different, although both the only originating artist in film is the screenwriter. You know, if you think about it, they're low man on the totem pole, but they are the originating artist.
Yeah.
They're the one that had the vision that the other people were used as tools to create.
Exactly. Exactly.
And most of us couldn't tell you who the screenwriter was for our favorite movie.
Exactly. And, you know, they'll quote that Betty Davis said, you know, fasten your seatbelts. Well, Betty Davis said it.
It's going to be a bumpy night.
You know, it's heartbreaking, really, for the screenwriter.
true.
Yeah, I guess I'd never really, really even thought about that because I think back to my favorite movies. You know, I think probably one of my all-time favorite was Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm-hmm.
Probably partly because of the association, because I saw it as a kid with my grandma the first time. So, you know, it was also a rare trip to the theater. And nuns there, too.
Yeah.
And because where I lived in a town where there wasn't a Catholic church, going to one that had a theater and Catholic nuns was like,
wowzer.
They're scary. They're scary. They're funny clothes. You know, I couldn't tell you who wrote the book. I'm sure there was originally a book, but book, screenplay, or the original
play. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, no idea.
See, that's the thing. And that's sort of tragic. Whereas if a composer usually will know who the composer is, like the composer is the originating artist, you know. And you can do an adaptation. Shakespeare is the originating artist, you know, you do the adaptation. So that's true today too, but unless you're really a nerd or something, an ultimate movie nerd and you know that, then you're unaware, you know.
Yeah, that's true. You know, if you really did pay attention to who the screenwriter was, and a lot of the other background information about a movie before you saw it, would it make that much difference to your experience?
I think you would, I think in a way. I used to, without realizing, you know, I would go into a movie, like, all I wanted to know was, where do I have to be? When's the screening? You know, I don't care what it is. I just, if I have to be there. And then I would find that I'm going, oh, this sounds like so-and-so's work, or this sounds like... And I'd be right, you know, usually. So it's like, you know, recognize someone's writing style or musical style or drawing style. So I don't know whether that would make you feel, if it would enrich in the experience, I might make you feel, yay, I realized something. Then again, maybe it would. I don't know. The more you know about something, I think.
Well, it might make you more inclined to go see a movie that you might otherwise pass on.
Exactly.
Because
yeah,
you know
true.
That a screenwriter that you have liked two of their movies,
that's
movie number
right.
three comes out, and it's not something that sounds real appealing, but you know it was
exactly.
written by that same screenwriter.
Exactly.
That would make a difference, I think.
Yeah.
Sure.
And just like, you know, all of us have favorite authors. And
mm-hmm.
even when they write something a little bit different, because most authors do at some point or another, they write something it sort of jumps aside from the actual books. I happen to be fond of a couple of authors that have written, were prolific and wrote a lot of sci-fi books and series. So,
who are they?
Anne McGaffrey was one and
oh,
Piers
I loved her.
Is another.
Is she still? And who was the other?
Piers Anthony.
Oh, yeah. I like both of them. I loved Anne and those dragon things.
Yes, the dragon.
I love all the dragons.
Killishandra, I think, was the other series.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure I was going to like it, you know, the Killishandra, but it still maintained the same general style.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people say, well, that's not fine literature. Well, sometimes you don't want highbrow.
Well,
you want something entertaining, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the other argument that you're up against. Like, if you write in a genre, you find that agents aren't willing, unless it's romance, which is, you know, sells like crazy, or a thriller, mystery thriller. Most agents don't want literature. They don't want genre, which genre people have to write to entertain. Literature, it seems to me that they write sometimes to just bore you silly. You know,
books that were absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
And they were written by well-known authors that, you know, certainly were never going to consider being independently published.
No.
And they were just downright awful. It was like an English assignment, and I'm 14 again.
Exactly.
It was awful. And, you know, can you write a positive review on that? I'm afraid not. I didn't.
Well, no, you shouldn't. The part of it is it's the reader and the writer, isn't it? I mean, you write it, you throw it out there, you do your best. Some people are going to like it, some people aren't, but it's, you know, you just have to be honest.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, things, and something that, you know, a friend of mine may really like, I may go through it and try to read it and think, this is really stupid. Or it's really, you know, crass or crude or whatever, you know, your word you want to assign to it. You just don't like it. It doesn't suit your taste.
What about, what's his name, Dan Brown? That guy, he really gets me nuts.
Is he the one that wrote the
Da Vinci Code? He's got
he wrote
new
Angel, the Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons.
Yeah, God, that guy gets me crazy. I was reading the first book, I couldn't stand it, and I kept saying to my husband, "Listen to this horrible," you know, and I'd read him like some awful.
I read the Da Vinci Code, and I was curious because people were up in arms about it.
Yeah,
you know, maybe living in the Bible Belt, I heard more of it. But
oh well, of course,
people were up in arms about it, and I thought, okay, I got to read this book. So I ordered it, and it arrived in due course, and I read it, and I thought, okay, it's fine, but I really wish I'd bought it at the used bookstore.
Exactly. It's like, I'll see it, you know, I'll get it in Netflix, you know.
I've never seen the movie. Not a huge movie fan, which may disappoint people, but I'm really not.
You're not?
No, I'm really not. I'm told I have ADD, but I find movies incredibly slow.
People tell me that all the time. I think everybody has ADD or OCD or something.
Something. I read a book.
Now that's me. I'm OCD.
Oh, you have OCD.
OCD.
How does this express itself?
Oh, am I ever.
What do you do?
She keeps her library cataloged in an
order. Ah.
Yes.
But do you put the colors together?
I have a personal library of over 3,500 books.
Good Lord.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a researcher of ancient civilizations.
Oh, well, that's
part of
wonderful.
My problem.
I want you to go on History Channel. I've got nothing but boys on there.
I find inaccuracies on there all the time.
Well, of course you do. You need to go on there. Well, anyway, I do love anything about Egypt and the Bible that they put on there. It's so fabulous.
I do. Now, I have a friend who has appeared on the History Channel on a number of their biblical specials.
Ooh.
Because he's a rabbi and
cool.
A biblical scholar. So
I
correspond
in the ancient history from a slightly different point of view. I'm interested in their foodways, so I want to see recreations of the foods that were eaten in various areas.
That's a good idea. Why don't you go? Why don't you pitch it? Got to pitch it to the History Channel.
Like,
it would be so entertaining to see. You know, I've tried a lot of things that aren't in the modern diet usually. Like these corn cakes, they were Navajo corn cakes are flavored with juniper ashes.
Is that like a dead friend of yours or?
No.
Oh, thank God. Okay.
But I will say that one corn cake kept me full all day long. Every time somebody asked me if I wanted another, I proudly held up my
corn
cake.
No, thank you.
That I absolutely.
I could see you two guys in little aprons and things of the period, whatever the Egyptians wore. with a really heavy coal eyeshadow, doing recipes.
Oh, yes.
I said that's fabulous.
An acceptable excuse for missing work in ancient Egypt was that you were staying home to brew beer.
Very sensible people.
Yes. They drank beer all the time.
Yeah.
And that was primarily what they drank. It probably didn't have a high alcohol content.
But it was enough to kill the germs.
That was one of their staples, was beer.
Wow.
Bread and beer. That's what they were generally paid in. You know, when I got into my research, it was like, oh, that's fascinating. They would pay them in bread and beer. Or,
you know,
whatever
and
that's
something that came up. My husband is fond of sci-fi series, past things done on television.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of these series, they had, you know, some alien colony with oppressed workers, you know, being slaves, mm-hmm. and they fed them bread and beer. Well, they didn't call it beer. They called it something else.
Yeah.
And they paralleled it to the ancient Egyptians because of the amount of vitamins and minerals that were found in this slightly alcoholic beverage. And it also, you know, sort of improved the slaves' mood.
Yeah, it would cheer them up a little bit. Yeah. Well, that's very nice.
A little easier to take, I guess, if you had your beer.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, with a low alcohol content, probably maybe 1% or 2%,
they could still work. Make
them intoxicated, especially since they were used to drinking it all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
so
you are going to have to think of something before, if you're going to do like a show, you're going to have more than just beer and bread.
Oh, well, there's also.
Oh, pigs.
If you explore your family history,
wow.
You discover the foods that were eaten 100 years ago.
Well, there you go. That's good, too.
You know, and it's really entertaining to go through. I'm going through a 20th century cookbook, not that far gone. But I found a number of things that I was, like, mystified about. One was something in a bottle called Wink.
Wink?
Wink?
Wink.
I know what
Wink
was.
I think I've heard of
I
that.
I had no idea what Wink was. Turns out it was grapefruit-flavored soda produced by Canada Dry. Who would have sold it in Mississippi? I don't know.
It sounds like something you would drink in Mississippi, like Orange
Wink.
Crush. Did you have Orange Crush and Grape Bat?
Coon Cheese was something else.
Wink tasted a little bit like, my God. All of a sudden, I just lost the name.
Mountain Dew.
A little bit like Mountain Dew.
Or Squirt?
Yeah. A little bit like Squirt. That's the one. But I remember Wink. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I have a recipe.
Too.
Two bottles of Wink, and I had no idea what it was. Another
bottles of it?
For a package of Coon Cheese.
Oh.
And I was like, got to be a brand name.
Well, it turns out that
it was a brand. There was a man, I'm thinking he was Edward Coon, but I could be wrong, and he lived in New York or Chicago, someplace up in that general area, and they had Pennsylvania. He had a number of cheese plants, and he had a patented process for curing cheese called the cooning process. Well, since he was named Coon. You know, he died in 1935. The only modern company that produces cheese starting in 1935 was a guy in Australia. Who would have marketed Coon cheese in Mississippi? I have no idea. Well, at first I thought, well, maybe it's one of these old racial slur things.
That's
what I initially thought it was.
Probably.
And so then, I'm researching, I'm using the internet. It probably refers to cheese made with this cooning process, which I guess is similar to what we all know as Cracker Barrel cheese, which is a common brand in the grocery store. And that it's similar to that, I guess. I don't know what size these packages were.
Sounds tasty.
I have no reference to size at all. It just says one package, Coon cheese.
I can see a big old cheese ball made out of Coon cheese. In the future. Yeah, and Coon cheese,
and
bread and beer.
Toad balls. I'm like, what on earth is a toad ball?
What are they?
Well, the recipe looks, because you mix sausage and Bisquick and Coon cheese.
Sounds
like what now is usually called sausage ball. It's a fried fritter thing with sausage in it. Ground sausage been cooked and then mixed with this batter, and then it's fried in like donut holes. Not uncommon. You see them like you're probably more apt to see them like at fairs and carnivals and places like that. It's not something most people make at home all that often.
No, I never have. I don't think I've ever seen one in all my life.
Well, yeah, I didn't have my first chocolate soda until I was in my 40s.
See, there
I
you go.
Some culinary delights, you know.
Fun. Yeah, I got to travel more to get some Coon cheese balls.
Well, so far I haven't found anybody who can tell me what Coon cheese is, but we're working on it. Yeah, Coon cheese was a mystery to me. And I'm sure as I go through this old cookbook, which the binding had become destroyed on, and so it's kind of like sort through it. It'll be interesting to see. And I've gone through other cookbooks. My grandmother had a copy, an original copy of the White House cookbook, which anybody who goes through old cookbooks will recognize. It was a real common one about the turn of the 1800. And, you know, even recipes that at that age become a little bit difficult to follow. And if you go before 1900, the leavening and whatnot can become really difficult, as well as the measurements. I mean, you know, a lump of butter the size of a hen's egg. Well, what? Okay, I've raised chickens. Hen's egg's very old. Yeah.
Large, extra large. What was it?
Yeah, you know, was it a, you know, a pullet egg or an old hen egg? And then there's, you know, teacup of this. Okay, teacups vary a lot, too. If anybody who...
Yeah, teacup.
Yeah. Fair amount of variation.
Or I always like a pinch or a dash.
Well, pinch
or
is
a handful.
Official amount.
A handful. You know, we all have different hand sizes.
Yeah. I actually did teach my daughter how you measured in your hand, though. Because it's something in my family we actually do. But we know, you take flour and your spoon, your measuring spoons, and you put a pile, you know, that amount in your hand, and you look at it until you can accurately gauge how much is in your hand. And it's just faster than getting out the spoon and carefully measuring. Now, some things are critical.
Oh, sure.
Baking some things is really critical. But
baking, you got to be careful.
Yeah. You
everything
know,
else, it's free lunch, you know?
My brother once made an angel food cake, and you could bounce it. So, folks, read the
directions
before you mix. Yeah. And,
well,
you know, from a family, I guess, we regard cooking as a sport. And
well, it is. It is a sport, isn't it, kind of? An art, I suppose.
You know, yeah, we do that. See who can do the best at whatever. And some of us are really good at it, and some of us fail miserably.
Indeed.
And that's just the way life is sometimes. We are getting ready to go on break. So, folks, if you want to take a look at Rita's book, even though we've talked about everything except...
I know. Well, we'll have to get to that thrilling saga.
Got to find out what Mud Flap does in the book's vessel. You can take a look at it on Goodreads or on Amazon, either one, if you put in the vessel, Rita Kempley.
Oh, and I have a fabulous trailer on YouTube, too.
Yes, I saw that trailer.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah,
it has
cool.
Nothing really exactly to do with the book, but it's a cool trailer.
Yeah, it is. You know, what I've discovered is a lot of times, even on TV, the advertisements, you're not sure what they were advertising or how it was relevant.
Exactly.
But you remember the commercial.
But and that is what you learn. Like, if you're ever going to get your book adapted and deal with the director, believe me, just lay back and relax, you know, because they're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah, you're done, and you're thinking, what did that dog have to do with beer?
Yeah, what?
I don't get it, but I remember the beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, folks, while we are away from your computer, take a minute, look up Rita's book, or you can look up Claudia's books, too. She'd be very happy to have you take a look at her books.
Hey, don't look up Claudia's books online.
Yeah. And in the meantime, we will be right back, so don't go anywhere.
Bye.
With Rita and Claudia.
Well, I took a walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the sands of time. But I watched the world go to the dark side of the moon. I feel there's nothing I can do. Yeah.
moon. After all, I would have to be something to do with you. I really don't mind what happens now and then, as long as you'll be my friend at the end. It's by the making, and will you still call me Superman? If I'm alive and well, will you be there holding my hand? I'll keep you by my side, with my superhuman my kryptonite. You call me strong, you call me weak, but still your secret I will keep. For granted, all the times I never let you down. You stumbled in and bumped your head. If not for me, then you'd be dead. I picked you up, put you back on solid ground. If I go crazy, then will you still call me Superman? If I'm alive and well, will you be there holding my hand? I'll keep you by my side with my superhuman might.
Issues, select other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Hello, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and along with my co-host, Victor the Voice Furman, with Second Sight NYC. Victor, who do we have as a guest this week?
Chris, our guest this week is Robert Moss. He's the creator of Active Dreaming, an original method of dream work and healing through the imagination. Born in Australia, he survived three near-death experiences in childhood. He leads popular seminars all over the world, and he's the author of the book, Dreaming the Soul Back Home.
I wonder if you could give me some advice on wet dreams. The last time I had a wet dream, I had to get flood insurance.
Everybody had a wet dream. Everybody saw the sunshine. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God, they're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put the... Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Hey everybody, this is Erica Getch, and I want to keep you connected every Friday night at 8 p.m. Pacific on The Galactic Connection. As always, I'll be taking your calls in the second hour, and as always, TGC is glad to be a part of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. So please check out TGCRadio.com. Hope to see you there.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news. But you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Wiped out, I guess.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I am your host, Gia Scott, and our guest host tonight, Claudia Dallaire, is with us. And tonight we are talking with Rita Kempley, the author of The Vessel. And don't forget, you can send your questions into my email, giascott@exogenynetwork.com. And before we get started, Claudia, you want to remind everybody where they can find your books?
They can find every one of my books on Amazon. Just type in my name and all four books will pop up. Simple as that.
Wow, Claudia, the same thing will happen if you type my name into Amazon. But there won't, darn it, there'll only be one book.
Well, if you type mine in, you only get one fiction book. But you get
chocolate.
And fudge.
And
ooh.
Fudge.
Yeah.
And fudge. We like fudge.
Fudge. Oh, well, I like fudge that doesn't fail. I am the queen
that's the
of
best
failed
kind.
Fudge. Yes.
You don't want no failing fudge.
No.
I have made fudge that greatly resembled the gravel mixed in with cement.
Mm-hmm. I've made it like a mud puddle.
Oh, I've had mud puddle fudge, too. That's from undercooking it.
Exactly.
The rocks are from overcooking it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In my house, my father made fudge. Oh, it was fabulous.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, it was fabulous.
Did you learn his fudge-making skills?
No, and I never got his fudge-making recipe either.
Well, maybe there'll be a fudge recipe in the 55 Fantastic Fudges to suit you. I have some positively no-fail ones because you do them in the microwave.
Ooh.
Yeah. I like
that. I can do this. I can nuke.
I can nuke too. I can nuke with the best ones. It even includes such a classic as, remember Velveeta fudge?
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
People used to make Velveeta fudge. Velveeta ensured that it was creamy and had the right texture.
Well,
wow,
now,
that sounds fabulous.
To make a strange transition, they don't have any chocolate in 2120 in the New York archipelago.
No, they don't. We could talk about eating kudzu, or was that just the goat?
Kudzu? Well, you know, apparently there are a lot of kudzu recipes.
There is. I'm not sure what it looks like. I'm told it grows here in the South.
Oh, it grows all over. You have to know what it looks like. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
the scourge of the South.
I didn't even know what poison ivy looked like.
Well,
so somebody told me that's what you just pulled up.
So you just camp out there with willy-nilly and no clue what you might be running into?
Actually, okay, my expertise in the plants and animals and everything was honed in the Southwest Desert. I moved to the South 10 years ago, and I'm like tenderfoot.
Oh.
You know, I do know some of the things. I have learned some of the edible plants and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, edible does not necessarily mean tasty, folks.
No, it does not.
Oh, no.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've tasted some less than wonderful things along the way. But anyhow, poison ivy is something I had no clue about. My mother is deathly allergic to it, and I had a horrible reaction to it while she was pregnant with me.
Mm.
It must be something I'm immune to because even after I pulled it up
mm-hmm.
with their hands,
well,
I never had a reaction.
I guess.
Am I going to go around rubbing it on myself on purpose? No.
I think that would be a silly idea.
Yeah. But I've gone tromping through it completely oblivious to the fact that it's there because poison ivy's one of these camouflaging plants. It can mm-hmm. be a vine, it can be a bush, it can be a shrub, it can be a low-growing plant. You never know what it looks
mm-hmm,
like.
Mm-hmm,
that's why I can't identify it, I guess.
Exactly.
Anyhow, it...
Want to talk about the end of the world as we know it?
End of the world. You had Hurricane Adolph.
At Hurricane Adolph, Swamp New York.
Yeah.
And it's Endurance.
Now, I know you had done before. Hurricane Sandy came along and did its magic.
I did that way before then.
Hurricane Sandy sort of made the possibility of this scenario strike close to home.
It really did. It was real. The whole thing, like doing the research, I just kind of made up the whole thing because I just sort of was so disturbed, I guess, by all the information about climate change years ago. But now that I've written it, I went back to kind of justify myself and did research, and it was really made me extremely sad to see that I was right. Hurricane Adolph is a possible. Now they're rethinking after all the recent hurricanes that they do much more damage than just wind damage now because the sea coasts are the ocean levels are rising and getting much more flooding inland and I forget it's not called the backwash but whatever it is that took out New Orleans and we're just going to see more of that and
storm
it's going to be worse.
Storm surge. In New Orleans, it was breaking canals as well. Yeah, I saw that when Greg and I were looking for a house, we initially started on the coast.
Yeah, and you should move back. You were right.
Well, the deal was we ran into difficulties with what is and isn't meeting current code and what's regarded livable versus not. Mm-hmm. And it became such a complicated mess. I looked at him one day because we just wasted 2 months on a deal for a house,
mm-hmm.
And we found out like 3 days before we were supposed to close
mm-hmm.
that we would never be able to get utilities turned on in the house.
Oh my God!
Ooh.
Okay, the house it was a converted garage actually.
Yeah.
It had not even been converted until after Katrina.
Wow.
This is what kind of a hodgepodge you were looking
crazy.
At.
Crazy.
I thought since it was occupied after Katrina, I was home free. Wrong.
Mm. Mm-mm-mm-mm.
Anyhow,
surprise.
I went down to the city and I said, look,
I don't want to waste any more time. I want to find a house. How do I avoid this happening? And they tell me, well, you have to have each and every one of them inspected first. Wow. And I'm like, oh, no.
Oh.
No. No, no, no. I'm not playing this patty cake game. It turns out that I didn't have access to the list that showed which properties were regarded as uninhabitable. Neither did the realtors nor the lenders. The only one that had access to it was the mayor. And I'm like, secret lists are really scary, folks. I don't play.
Well,
I said, no, we're let's look inland. And we started looking inland at houses. And we looked all over Mississippi. And we finally ended up just north of Hattiesburg in a small town. And it's close enough that the coast is very accessible to us. It's far enough that we don't get storm surge. And it's south enough we don't get very many tornadoes. Not that tornadoes are impossible, but we get fewer. Because they actually had one in Hattiesburg this spring that did a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't usually get as many big tornadoes. Because tornadoes, they're like eggs that come in lots of sizes.
Yeah.
So when you think about these end-of-the-world scenarios, at least in my case, you know, I thought, okay, what is plausible? And
well,
in one case, you know, I played on very different things from what you did. You played on the weather and climate change.
Yeah. And I seriously based it. Like, there was last year, I mean, my God, there were almost 30,000 different records broken in terms of heat. And the hotter the water gets, you know, that was 3,800 high temperature records fell. There were 19 wildfires, 500 acres in several states were burned by June. Then you've got these frightening scenarios where people are taking money from the oil companies, the senators, Republicans and senators, and some Democrats are just taking contributions and keep goosing oil and coal industries. It's really very, very sad, I find. And some of the ocean levels, they've got them raising anywhere from 8 inches to 210 inches, you know, by 2030. So you're lucky that you're going in when I think it absolutely is nutty to stay on the shore when you look at all the information. You're just crazy. Yeah,
well, initially, I was looking for something actually that was in the flood zone.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't going to build a house on it.
Mm-hmm.
We were simply going to put a travel trailer on it with the plan of when a storm comes, not if, when a storm comes, we just hitch up to the travel trailer and tow it out of harm's way.
Well, that's for sure. Yeah. But they figure they're
if you're going to live on that kind of terrain, that's kind of what the kind of house you need.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But they figure there are like 55 different cities that will be 4 feet will be high tide, above high tide by 2030. So that's not going to be good. It doesn't sound like that horrifying, but it pretty much is. And I don't know.
Well,
that sort of got me going.
Description of New York City in this post-apocalyptic flooded world.
What's it like?
Well, you know, it was very similar to what I saw in New Orleans after Katrina.
Yeah.
On the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
Granted, the water wasn't standing on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. New Orleans being a soup bowl kind of place.
Yeah.
It kind of held the water for a while.
New York is too.
But
Miami.
You know, the only thing you left out was the smells. Of course, after 20-some years of being flooded, the smell would have dissipated to a degree.
I threw in just a brief mention of the smell,
I think it was the swamp when the guy got stuck in the swamp.
Yeah, they got stuck in the swamp. It's very swampy. It's very nasty. And they're really only they're just beginning to, you know, discover or get back into doing some light manufacturing, but most of the goods that they find are by these people called scrabbers who dive down into the bottoms of old skyscrapers that are now underwater and get out all the pricey goods and then sell them to the rich folks.
And when you talked about, you know, a fancy rich people's
you know, buffet party, and they're showing they're eating such delicacies as Vienna sausages and beans.
Ooh.
I'm thinking of all the things to call delicacies from the
20th century. I love it.
Yeah, Vienna sausages weren't going to be on my list.
It's pretty funny.
Maybe spam?
Yeah, well, they would have a little spam, probably. Somebody would probably dig it up. It's kind of funny, you know, they don't have anything that they have, like, if they have beautiful gowns and that, they're all very, very old and worn out. They have nothing really that's, they make, basically everything has to go to, distilling water, you know, and coming up with some kind of air conditioning because it's very, very hot as it would be. And there's bugs
and
all over.
Based on scavenging from previous civilizations, which kind of makes you think back to when other civilizations have fallen.
Exactly.
We know that Egypt and Greece and Rome and many other countries, when a civilization fell, the monuments and buildings that were once so important were often scavenged to build new things.
They just did that in Belize.
Absolutely.
In Belize, they had done that just recently. They were on top of them for taking some of the Mayan ruins to make a road. Just anyway, but
And even in Egypt, depending upon the dynasty, even from dynasty to dynasty, they would dismantle temples and use the stones for something else.
Yeah.
So
recycling's been around for a while, it seems. You know?
It certainly has.
Exactly.
But, you know, if you think about it, and what you were, basically there was nothing left, I think of the Middle Ages, really, where they took apart a lot of the Colosseum and all those places and started to build what they could out of it and looked up at all these marvels and wondered how they had done it, you know? So, yeah, I think in my book they still have some awareness, and they still have to have some technology because they're wealthy people do something called, what is it called? I should know since I thought it up. It's a form of resurrection. What they do is they have themselves cloned, but the difference is you don't clone yourself and then just vanish. You have all of your brain, your memories and thoughts and ideas transferred into your brain, which is really pretty much already possible. So you're like 35 and you decide you want to be 18 again, and you zap right back into your body, your new body.
Ooh.
But it's very expensive, of course, and so all the poor folks end up schlepping around carrying like the organs that they give away to charity, you know, over to the poor folks, because you know you give your body away and you have to take it off your taxes. Because it's charity deduction. Don't find that funny.
and sort of the way people regard what they call dupes.
Exactly. They're called dupes, yeah. They call them dupes. And, you know, of course they don't like them. The poor folks don't like them. But, you know, you end up, you need a liver, and it's sclerotic, you know, because they don't take care of themselves, the rich people. Because, you know, they can go back into their vessels. That's what the clones are called, vessels. That's the title of the vessel. But it is funny, even though it sounds sad. And,
some of the stuff in there, like these, this, dissident faction.
The
evangelicals. Based on a distorted version of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And they wear what they call Jesus sandals.
Yes. Holy shit.
For the holy shit. Which is, you know, by stepping into the manure from
They're on the parade, a very holy parade day, yes. And it's the caisson that carries, you know, the reverend. And so when you wear those sandals and you step in the road apples, they become holy shits and are very revered. Claudia. Didn't they do that in Egypt?
Yeah.
Claudia, darling. Claudia's falling off her chair or something.
Yeah, she's in
shock. I'm here, but I have a cat climbing all over me.
Well, I have a cat who's asleep. So there.
Oh,
my cat was climbing over me, and now he's asleep. But let me tell your cat story. Let me tell your cat the story.
Mine has decided to become very active. This is my lovely little black cat who looks very much like the goddess Bast.
And
when
nice.
I'm not paying enough attention to her, she lets me know.
Well, see, they all do. So anyway, did they have any holy, you know, sandals in Egypt? The magicians, did they wear holy sandals covered with dung?
Nope. Ancient Egyptian priests wore reed sandals.
Well, so they did wear sandals.
They wore, but they had to be made of reeds. They couldn't be made of leather.
But did they step in camel dung or anything like that?
Oh, no, we didn't have camels in ancient Egypt. That's another mistake. Everyone thinks that, you know, they associate camels in Egypt.
Yes.
No, camels weren't introduced until, I think it was either the Greek or Roman period.
Ah, so fairly late in history.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you know that they have camel beauty pageants today?
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. And how do I know that? Because that one of the prize-winning most beautiful camels was cloned successfully.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, how fabulous.
Yeah. So that, you know, it can be done. You can be cloned. You and your camel can both be cloned.
Well, I
wearing your sandals.
There's a company, I'm thinking it was in Korea,
South Korea.
That will clone your pet for you.
Oh, yeah. They've already done it.
Yeah.
It's the same guy that...
I think it costs about $25,000.
Yeah, some people in Florida had that
done. I told my husband, I said, you know, I have a dog named Red Dog who is like my best buddy. And she's getting up there. She's going on 12 now.
Okay.
You know, I told him, I said, I want to have Red clones.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of looked at me. I said, it's not that expensive. And he just kind of looked at me. I said, it's only $25,000. And he just rolled his eyes. He never even said anything.
Well, I can tell you how much it costs. It's like in 2008, this couple from Boca Raton paid that South Korean scientist who was by the guy, for instance, the guy who was you know, said he had cloned humans or some such that and was discredited. But anyway, he does run this group. But they paid $155,000 to clone their golden laboratory retriever.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and they were, you know, they were thrilled. And he appeared on the Today Show. And there you go. So,
yeah, but, you know, everybody has always wanted one of Red's puppies, but I've never bred Red, so she's never had puppies.
Well, for only $155,000.
Yeah. Only.
That's a lot of books. That's a lot of radio shows.
That's a lot of radio shows, a lot of books, it's a lot of vacations, it's a lot of months of living expenses.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't think I'll be cloning Red Dog.
And you know, they've come very, very close to actually giving, it's close, but it's not quite there where you can take an egg and you can take some sperm and you can mix that up and then you can put it in another egg that has had the DNA removed, and then put that in a surrogate, and it's very close to cloning. And they came within 3 months of birth with one of these. And the sad thing, it was a couple in China, and it was close enough that they could recognize that the baby looked like the father, and they were of course devastated. So. It's now been declared illegal in this country and also in China, but I mean, I would be surprised if somebody hasn't already cloned somebody out there.
Mm-hmm.
Creepy, but there you go.
Yeah, it is a little creepy.
Yeah, but what we've had cows, goats, horses, pigs, mules, rats, rabbits, deer, ferrets, wolves, water buffalo, mice, cats, dogs, wildcats, rhesus monkeys, camels, and so on. all of those cloned.
Wow.
Successfully. You know? How's about that?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how far they've come. And, you know, you don't address a whole lot of the morality directly in the book, but it does come up, especially in dealing with this dissident religious group.
Yeah.
You know, do you see cloning as being much of a moral issue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't want to, like, beat anybody over the head. I just thought, I'll just throw it out here and let people think about it, you know. And I think the heroine has to deal with that. But it's going to be a moral issue. I mean, any kind of reproductive process that's been thought up like it used to be, test tube babies were thought to be just, you know, playing God, and the Catholic Church was against it, you know, and, you know, Satan was involved in all this. But now, of course, there are the people who are saying, do not destroy, you know, these embryos that people have frozen so that they could possibly have children. So and probably millions of Catholics today are test tube babies, you know. And so it seems that, I don't know, maybe anyway a human can be creative and the human can, I suppose, be ensouled. I don't know. I mean, it's sort of above my head. I don't know. Once you're here, it seems to me that you're deserving of being treated as kindly as possible by your fellow man. That's just sort of how I look at things, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange dilemma to think of. When does a human get a soul or a spirit?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly.
Is it at birth? Is it at conception? You know, how does this happen? I've never devoted a great deal of thought to it. I have to confess that.
I did devote a lot of thought to it. You know, I just, you know, I'm a, you know, I think probably a flaming liberal, but I do have to say that you do have to say that life starts with conception. It does. But does the whole being, is the whole being there? I don't know. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point, you know, when you become aware that you exist, it seems to me that you must in some way be ensouled. I don't know.
Even when you drag in that first breath, you know, you acquire your soul or spirit at the same time.
Don't you think?
Well, it kind of makes sense, you know.
Yeah, it's just
when that spark is, you're no longer this dependent, essentially a parasite.
No, you're not.
Reduction is very much like a parasitic connection. So, you know, and I have to admit, you know, people have often told me I'm not very maternal in that way. When
I'm not either, but
you know, I felt like I did have a space alien inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't like me very much, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. I think that's sort of what I'm addressing too, you know.
Yeah.
Like a little bit of that. Like I have this thing called Mama's Little Helper, which is this sort of a womb with that you put in. It's a artificial womb, and you put it in your bedroom wall, and you put the baby, you know, your little baby in there. And you don't have any, like, swollen ankles. You got no problems, perfect, you know, there's a perfect temperature, no disease, no nothing, lullabies. You watch baby, you know, grow and as you go to sleep instead of watching your TV or whatever it is you do. And I really don't think that's such a bad invention, but, you know, and would that baby have a soul? I guess so. I think we all somehow do. Don't you think it's conscience? Some of us,
us
are.
And I have to admit, even though I do believe in the existence of, you know, a non-physical aspect of us, if I had the option of your mama's little helper in the wall, guess where mine would have been. And it's not because I don't love my kids.
No,
but it's a case of I just didn't do well at the reproduction thing, you know.
That's what so many people tell me, you know. And, you know, like I'm thinking athletes, you know, movie stars.
Or
like
even
if you're in a series.
You have reproductive problems. Some women have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
You know, in my case, I didn't do well at getting pregnant or staying pregnant. Those were difficult things to do.
And
I'm
not alone
in that, you know, and so for me, if I could have just had it all mixed in the petri dish.
Yeah, I had Mama's little helper. Totally, you know, climate controlled.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I no interruption to my work schedule.
No puking.
Yeah, because I always knew when I was going to have the baby, because that was the first day I didn't throw up.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah. Mom, drink wine, toast the baby, whatever you want to do.
You
know?
And am I immoral? No, I don't regard myself.
No.
If that was a safe and viable option, I would have chosen it in a heartbeat. I'll admit that right now.
I think a lot of people would. They've told me that. Some people have told me they loved being pregnant.
I've known some women like that. Unfortunately, with the age when I was doing this, all the women I knew loved being pregnant, and I was the only one.
Really? Wow.
Ooh. Well, I feel like, you know, I had dreams where I was so big, I couldn't get in buildings anymore, and they had the tent maker come to me.
Yeah, you can't get up out of the chair. You know,
the tent maker appeared in my nightmares.
Yeah, constantly having to pee. You don't get that with Mama's little helper.
Yeah, I mean, no worries about, they don't call it toxemia anymore. Now it's something else.
There's really no worries about, you know, like you won't get any illnesses. You won't have any diseases or anything like that.
More premature births.
Pardon?
More premature births and all
nope.
the problems that come from those.
Absolutely
not. No more
not.
Birth-induced injuries.
Nope. None of that.
No more issues caused by environmental concerns, you know, things that you're exposed to.
Exactly. No more, you know,
nutritional deficiencies.
Yes, diabetes that women can develop.
I mean, it would be a huge reduction in our health care.
Exactly. It's a great plan.
Well, you know, if that's the way people did pregnancy, you know, you could have your kids when you were ready, not
Absolutely.
When body said, okay, now.
Absolutely. It's really a good product, and I wish we were selling it to my kids. I think we make money.
Well,
I do.
Sure.
I mean,
the only three that are sitting here going, you know, that'd be a great little doodad.
Oh, you have no idea, because I chose not to have children.
You did,
and
now
I
you would,
did.
Though.
And but if something like that were available and they could screen out medical issues that you know you're going to pass on to your child, that would be fabulous. Because that's why I chose not to have children.
Mm-hmm. A lot
was
of people.
So that my children wouldn't go through what I did.
What did you go through? My goodness. Are you willing to say?
I was diagnosed at the age of 23 with a precursor to cervical cancer.
Ooh, that's horrible.
Because of the drug my mother took during pregnancy.
Oh, dear.
I endured 11 surgeries in 20 years.
Oh, my God.
So every other year I was having surgery for something or other.
Gosh.
And I never would have wanted a child of mine to go through that. Not going to have them.
Pardon? I know women who've gone through all sorts of health problems due to injuries that occurred to them during birth.
Sure.
And needed several surgeries to correct the damage that had been caused by the birth. Couldn't have any more children because of that. And so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these people who have, I have a daughter who's got type 1 diabetes.
Yeah.
Her pregnancy was a very difficult process.
Absolutely.
You
and
know,
sometimes you end up with diabetes as a result of pregnancy, too.
Right.
I've had a friend that happened.
She developed diabetes as a teenager. And, you know, so it would be, you know, for her, you know, where she wanted to have two children, she could have two children.
For sure.
Yep.
Absolutely you could. Really, it is good. It's a good plan. It's just, you know, I mean, if there were some other people who disagreed with us, I'm sure they'd say we were going to hell and
So far, I haven't got any hateful hat mail.
Good, I'm glad, because I hate hat mail. I like hat mail. I like all my
girl, she would write me hat notes. We still teach her about it.
People write you hat notes?
My daughter did. I hat ooh. Ooh men to me.
I hat you.
She couldn't spell diddly. Anyhow, we'll still tease her about that.
Let's talk about your survivalist story. Gia, what happens in your
survival? It was an entirely different premise. It wasn't earth changes and a storm. It was a series of things. There was food shortages resulting
from, can be.
There was a flu. They called it the Jamaican jig.
Ooh.
Because people would start acting really goofy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how people like to give funny names to every disease that comes down the pike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's highly contagious, and it was brought in by boat people who landed on the coast.
Uh-huh.
Illegally.
Oh.
It spread. Okay, it caused all sorts of repercussions down the pike. And it went through in two waves. And it was also transmitted worldwide because everybody knows America loves to travel.
Yes, exactly.
So this highly contagious virus was spread very quickly. And it took, by the time the CDC had figured it out, it had already wreaked its havoc. Now, the people involved in the story don't necessarily, they know about the Jamaican jig. They don't know about everything that's happening because nobody would. Each group has its own particular knowledge based on what they saw. Now, one of the characters in the book is a villain because he is the bad guy that created an artificial virus as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this Illuminati-like group has contracted him, and they've cultivated him since he was in medical school, and he gets in some sort of a scrape, a jam of some sort, never really talked about. But that's how they get their hooks in him. And he's a very successful physician in a city and has a wife and two kids, and he's an OCD kind of guy. I mean, you know, and his wife is kind of like, am I married to a man or a machine? Anyhow, she's expected to be the perfect wife, and the children are expected to be perfect as well. And then one day he gets a wild hair because he's finished the virus. He's created it. He has completed the research into the delivery method. He knows exactly how it's going to be delivered. And hopefully I haven't gone into no man's land.
I don't think you have.
Oh, nope. I heard a sound. I was like, oop, did I drop into zombie land someplace?
Limbo.
The virus is delivered, and I'm not going to tell how it is because it's part of the story.
No, you better not.
But he gets sort of a conscience early on with this process before it's delivered. And he arranges for an escape place for his wife. He decides he wants a third child, which she had wanted before, and he didn't want, you know, how that goes. He decides he wants a third child. He buys this sort of mansion, southern mansion kind of place, an antebellum sort of house in the boonies someplace near some little town called New Hope. It's a standing joke with my husband and I that we're looking for New Hope when we go on a road trip. Anyhow, New Hope got a little general store and a little cafe and a little post office and, you know, a little of this, a little of that, and not much of anything. And the store dates from pre-Civil War era. And this particular area, you know, was apparently in the South. You always get the impression it was in the South. But it was really unaffected by the Civil War because of the lack of affluence. Nobody had slaves. There were Indians in the area and so forth and so on. And that's where his family goes. Well, when he delivers the virus to the Illuminati-like group's henchmen, they are instructed to infect him as well.
So he's
not going to be able to join his family. And the virus has some really horrific effects. Short-lived, but so are the people who are sick with it.
And, you know, that pretty much puts a kibosh on civilization at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of a zombie-like thing, perhaps. But they're not like the zombies. They don't eat brains, and they aren't the undead forever or anything like that. And I was actually curious, you know, is such a virus that affected your neurological systems possible? So I actually did ask a brain surgeon, literally. Yeah, but it's brain surgery too, right? You know, is this really possible? You know, and they're like, well, theoretically. And I'm like, that's all I need, theoretical.
Yeah. Well,
not really trying to do it. I don't need practical application, okay? Thank you very much. Yeah. Nobody wants to see the end of the world, but I think with, you know, the age I am, I've seen enough of the end of the world predictions, Y2K, this, that, and the other thing, you know, that we're having the end of the world all the time. When the world was to end, that guy, you know, Harold, I think his name was Harold Camp. But he was some minister who had, you know, predicted, figure out from the Bible that that's what.
Oh, yeah, that guy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We've had him, you know, and there is UFOs and there is these werewolf-like creatures. They're not werewolves. They don't shift shapes or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. This is in your book, or are you saying in the world?
No. They're in the book. You've got to have a little bit of weird stuff, too, you know, because ghosts, you know, yeah. Ghosts, as well as a connection with old history, kind of runs through it.
Sounds good.
Little SP, you know, a little weird stuff all coming together.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have people that are a little bit different from the norm.
Well, of course.
Most of the people that are surviving and feature prominently in the story are kids.
That makes sense.
Well, you know, when you imagine a world gone crazy, you know, where do the kids go? Do the kids survive? And I think that's where I was seeing it from, is who is likely to survive and why.
Mm-hmm.
And kids are a likely place because they tend to be smaller, more alert, see the world in a different way, and so forth and so on. But they don't know everything, so a lot of things are sort of blundering.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they have a little less ego involved, too.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more fear.
Well, and yeah, unless their minds are more flexible.
Yeah, because when you actually think about, when you really seriously look at an end of the world scenario, you're kind of seeing a case where a lot of people don't survive, not because they don't have the means and the knowledge, but because they are unable to adapt.
Yeah, and they just are so old, they just can't bear to, you know,
Trina, you know, people, a lot, you know, all the evacuated people, because you tended to cluster, you know, found a place to be. And you watched them, and who was the most adaptable, who was able to shift as, you know, the sand or water was shifting, because Katrina was a really uncertain thing for people who had evacuated. You're seeing the news reports, and at first, okay, because I actually lived in Metairie, not in New Orleans proper, and that's Jefferson Parish. And it's nestled in greater New Orleans. It's nestled between Kenner and New Orleans proper. Well, the first news reports said New Orleans is underwater and Kenner was underwater. Well, if the two sides are underwater, the middle probably is, too.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a lot of hills going on here.
Yeah.
And so everything's underwater. There's nothing left, you know, and there's this shock of, do I have any reason to ever go back? Because like everybody else, we all left 3 days' worth of clothes.
Yeah.
You know, you've got 3 days' worth of clothes. Everybody figured 3 days we'll be back home. Mm-hmm. Nobody anticipated this kind of damage. Not the people. That's through Camille, not FEMA, not the mayor. Nobody expected what happened.
you know, everybody wants to point the finger at this group or that group. Nobody saw it coming.
Right.
In fact, I almost didn't evacuate, but my daughter was visiting me. And as a diabetic, you know, she does have complications.
Yeah.
And she needs a hospital.
Yeah. Smart that you left.
Lost 6 o'clock on Saturday. I'm not evacuating. At 10 o'clock, when I looked at the NOAA website and it showed Katrina, it filled the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
That's when I said, there's no way it's missing us. And I told her, I said, pack your stuff. We're leaving.
Good.
And, you know, I actually called my boss on Sunday morning from northern Louisiana and said, in case you hadn't noticed, I'm gone. I'm not there. And that was that, you know, and a month later I came home. My house never flooded.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my friends lost everything.
I
had probably had the least to lose, but I didn't lose anything. The tree that fell on my house broke apart first. I lost a few shingles. The only place the water got inside the house was the bathroom. The power had been turned on 4 days after the storm. I had a 50-cent size piece of mold in the bottom of my refrigerator.
Wow.
And petrified sausage patty laying on a platter of condiments that were in there. Everything left in my freezer was frozen again.
Mm-hmm.
It was spoiled. It all went directly to the trash, but I didn't have to smell it because it was already frozen.
Great.
You know, so even though the entire city reeked of rotten refrigerator, and it did, rotten refrigerator and worse, mildew, I mean, the smell was awful. There were lots of days mentholated ointment on my upper lips so that I couldn't smell anymore because it would make you so sick. They told us that the smell was coming from the chicken plants on the river. But they brought in the corpse dogs about 6 months after the storm, 6-8 months right at that time period, and they found bodies. So I'm sure that we weren't just smelling the chicken plant.
Yeah.
But think about that stuff. I mean, you had to. You just had to not think about it.
Okay.
And, you know, the smell probably took a year to go away, the smell of mildew. Because people were tearing down, tearing out, replacing, renovating, repairing, you know. A year of everything smelled like mildew all the time, which I think is a horrible smell.
Yeah.
Probably like it less now because it reminds me of that time period. As you would drive on the Gulf Coast, because I did make a trip to Florida, I think it was in November after the storm. So we'd driven along the Gulf Coast to see what Highway 90 looked like. For anybody who's familiar with Mississippi, Highway 90 parallels the coast. And you would see debris, blankets, clothing, stuff, people's stuff, caught in the trees 25-30 you know, it was absolutely amazing at the amount of damage that had been done.
Mm-hmm.
And until you're standing there looking at it, it's really hard to imagine.
Yeah.
It really is. You know, even a year after the storm, when my daughter came to visit again and I took her to Florida again, she was shocked and horrified because there were still things caught in the trees. We get up there to get them out.
Yeah.
And it was really obvious that this wasn't coming together like that. Everybody thought that, recovery, you know, once the casinos are open, everything's fine. No.
No.
It takes a little longer than that.
Well, that's cheery. We've cheered people up, I bet. Any fabulous? How about some floods and famines from the Egyptian people?
Yeah, well, we haven't done a whole lot of famine. I haven't even had anybody with a famine story.
No, there are no good famine stories. That's get on top of that.
you know any good famine stories from Egypt?
I can always find good famine stories from Egypt.
Stories from Egypt, huh?
Oh, there's some good famine stories from Egypt?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Whoa, what are they like?
At the end of the Old Kingdom, there was famine for a number of years, and
one of the few times in Egyptian history where people actually resorted to cannibalism.
Wow.
That's how bad it was. Wow. And, you know, a lot of people don't know that. It's not, you know, it's not something that is presented in a good light.
Mm-hmm.
Because that would, according to their religious beliefs, that was just, that was the worst thing that you could do.
That, because then there would just, that person could never come back.
Correct. Uh-huh. So,
wow.
So it's, you know, it's not something that's, you know, you won't find it in history books. You will find it, you know, if you dig deep enough.
I've never heard of it. No.
Or did that happen at the fall of the Old Kingdom?
Correct. That was one of the reasons why the Old Kingdom collapsed, was because of this famine. And actually, it didn't just occur in Egypt. It occurred throughout the Middle East. So something happened. There was a climate change. And it led to a great upheaval. That's why some other empires disappeared as well. So
That's interesting.
It's very interesting to read some of this. I have to laugh when I correspond with my friend who's a biblical scholar, because, you know, he will talk about the Exodus from Egypt and, you know, why they left. They were enslaved. And what I have learned is, no, the Hebrews were not slaves in Egypt, because there were different types of slavery, and the Hebrews were not slaves. They were workers. They just didn't want to work anymore. So they decided to leave, and when they did leave, they moved to the Sinai Peninsula, which was also part of the Egyptian Empire.
Right.
So where did they go?
Exactly.
They didn't leave Egypt.
Did they circle
so
back?
I find this, no, the Sinai Peninsula had always been part of the Egyptian Empire. Anything south of Kadesh was part of the Egyptian Empire. Anything north of Kadesh was part of the Hittite Empire. There were two major superpowers. You either lived with the Hittites or you lived with the Egyptians.
So what were they doing?
So, yeah, so what were they thinking?
What were they thinking? They were thinking of creating their own empire, I guess.
Apparently.
Maybe feeding their families, you know, especially if the Exodus occurred during the famine.
Yeah.
But it didn't.
Looking for that. It didn't, huh?
And
no.
The Exodus did not occur during a famine. The Exodus occurred, supposedly, during the New Kingdom, which was the biggest prosperity time in ancient Egypt. Why would you leave?
What is going on with that?
I find
a lot of the biblical stories very entertaining.
Well, they're very, very interesting, but they're not, they don't seem accurate.
They're not.
Clearly.
There are a lot of inaccuracies.
We're drawn to a close here on our program tonight. So, Claudia, you want to tell them real quick how to find your blog?
I don't know if my blog is still up and running.
Ah, okay.
All of my books are available on Amazon, three nonfiction books on ancient Egyptian magic, and one novel, a mystery set in ancient Egypt.
Okay. And Rita, you want to tell everybody where to find the vessel?
Okay. I have thevesselbook.com, which talks about cloning, climate issues, link between computers and brains, history of cloning, and so forth and so on, if you want to know what I base the book on. I have a blog at ritakempley.com, in which I talk about everything. And I'm told you're not supposed to do that, but I do anyway. And you can buy the vessel at amazon.com. Just look up the vessel with my name, Rita Kempley, and you shall, if you choose, be the proud owner of a vessel.
Okay.
Either on Kindle or POD.
All right. Well, unfortunately, folks, we have run out of time all too quickly again. But I hope that tonight's program has provided you a little entertainment and plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next time as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea as we continue our Authors Conversation series. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
With a 100-foot pole, sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, he'll just have anything on the show. You know what?